Access number 29540, Mr. Norman Cole, Real 5. Now, what happened when you got to Arbender Arquinay? We've talked a bit about the situation, but what happened when you got there?
Well, first thing we had to do is to get into between two hedges, about about 15 feet apart. It was sort of almost like a pathway up between them. There was infantry already dug in, facing both ways. That was the first surprise. Then we realised that we were a finger going up into enemy territory, and we had to dig in one side, of course, and set up our observation post facing in one direction.
How exactly did you set up your OP?
Well, it was a matter of digging a dugout, first of all, to protect yourself against shell splinters, and then we set up our instruments on the edge of the dugout.
And what instruments would you set up there?
Well, the nearest you can describe it, really, is a binocular theodolite.
The one we've already discussed.
Yes.
So that, anything else you'd set up?
No, I mean, we'd have binoculars, and that's the only thing we would use in that position, because it rather limited the space, of course.
Now, you were looking for targets. Did you see any targets?
No.
Now, what happened next? Did you come under fire at all there?
No.
What about
no, they seemed to have drawn back. It was rather surprising. They went out the night before we got there when the infantry were moving in and put out some mines in both sides of that hedgerow to prevent the Germans coming up secretly during the night or impeding them during the day, of course. But no Germans ever appeared there.
Now, one thing you mentioned is the Moaning Minis, the rocket. You seem to have thought you got a fire from them while you were there.
They didn't actually land on us there, nearby, but it's like a series of rockets coming over in quick succession. And they come sort of, whoa, 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 like this, you know, and you had the nickname of Moaning Minis.
But they didn't actually land near you?
No, not very far away. They killed a sergeant not all that far away, of course, fairly near.
Now, what happened next then?
Well, we weren't there very long before we were pulled back. I think the thing was, we were, without knowing it, we were rather sort of cut off from the rest of the invasion at that point, weren't we? The Germans had driven tanks through almost to the coastline and cut us off, and then they had to pull back. And from that point, we got on to our general movement after that. We pulled away from that position.
Now, one unusual thing is that this officer asking for black plimsolls. Tell us that story.
Well, yes, whilst we were there, the local Mackey, the Free French forces, were fairly nearby. And there was a major there who came into the into this between these two hedges where we were, and asked if anybody had some black plimsolls he could borrow, as if you'd ever see him again. But he wanted some black plimsolls because at night they had to go through, creep forward and make contact with the local Mackey. The soldiers were going with them. They were all done up with black faces and camouflaging everywhere they could possibly have it, because there was about two or three of them going to accompany him up to this secret meeting. But the soldiers were hanging around. The officer disappeared, and he came back after a few moments to say the whole thing had been cancelled. And the thing that struck me at the time, I remember, was the soldiers were disappointed. I'd have been over the moon it was called off. Were they actually disappointed that they weren't going forward into enemy territory to make this contact?
Now, what happened next then? You were pulled back from this isolated position. Where did you go back to?
I can't remember that offhand.
Just back, further back?
Yes, yeah. Not to any particular town. Or...
Now, what do you remember of this period? Is this the first sort of 5 or 6 days?
Well, it wasn't very long from then, of course, before we moved on towards Benneville. This was early enough days that the parachutists who'd landed and captured the Pegasus Bridge were still there waiting to be collected and complaining a lot, because they understood they would fall in, do their job, capture it, they'd be relieved and immediately brought back to this country. And they were hanging around there waiting to be picked up. as we sort of moved into Benneville for our first real setup for action.
And did you encounter much of that? What state were they in, the parachutists?
Just sitting there moaning. They were fed up to the teeth that they hadn't been picked up. They'd done their job very efficiently, obviously. They captured what we now call the Pegasus Bridge area. And they'd been relieved by, I think it was the 3rd British Div got through to them.
Now, what happened when you got to Benneville?
Well, we had to find a position.
You were shelled on your way forward, weren't you?
Yeah, there was a lot of shelling.
About that. What do you remember of that?
Just a lot of shelling at these Moaning Minis they were using a lot, trying to destroy the troops that were coming in off the beaches, obviously. We didn't get hit with anything at all. We got through. And then when we got through Benneville, we went into the grounds of a huge maternity home. And I decided the obvious place for this observation post was on the roof.
Tell me about that, setting up the OP on the post.
Yeah, well, we unloaded, of course, and went in through this nursing home and climbed up through, got through onto the roof, and actually did set up our instruments there, ready to start observing. And we were actually working there, and in the night, the first night, a very large shell landed very near to the maternity home. We heard it coming, just missed us, in effect. You could hear it whistling by. And obviously, we couldn't stand up there then because there was more coming. We came down through the staircase in the dark. And I think I'll tell the story. We thought the water main had been hit because we got showered as we were coming down. And got down and into the middle of the building to get as much protection as possible until it was all over. And stayed there then for a little while until the shelling stopped. It was getting light by then, and when we went up, we saw the sort of the water main being burst. What had happened? We'd knocked over a fire extinguisher and set it off, and it was pouring water over us. But we get up onto the observation post, and after a little while, the matron came up and said to me, she thought it was quite wrong that we had an observation post on the hospital because we had a Red Cross painted on the roof. And I tried to tell her that we weren't there to actually fire anything at all. We were there just to observe and protect. But I had to accept what she was saying, that we were there under a Red Cross. So I agreed we would move out. And there was a water tower in the grounds. So that was obviously the next best place. And it made quite a good observation post. We moved into the water tower.
What sort of water tower was it? How was that feasible?
Well, it was sort of a concrete structure, sort of poking up through the trees in the nearby wood.
How tall, roughly?
Oh, I should think about 50 feet, 60 feet, something like that. Quite a tall structure.
And whereabouts, what was it like on the roof, at the top of it, where you actually set up?
Well, we were set up, not actually at the top, because there were slots all the way around it. It was like there was a roof, but so they could get in and maintain it, I suppose. We were able to get in under the roof of this thing with a good observation through these slots around, all around the sides of the water tower. It was good for observation there.
Now, you also established some defences to it as well.
At that time, Germans could have been anywhere. I mean, we were newly landed, comparatively. And suddenly I had the thought that if they sent a patrol out and realised where we were, they could creep up through the staircase and throw a grenade in at us and curtains. So what we did, we sort of strung a piece of string across the bottom of the staircase with some empty tin cans on it. We're in the dark. If anybody came then, it made such a din we'd have known, and we had some grenades ready to throw down the staircase if anybody did come.
But they never did.
They never did.
Now, what could you see from up there? Were you actually guiding guns, or was it just...
Yes and no. At night, we could pick up the flashes of German artillery. Yes, we were looking for the flashes of German artillery. And if, for instance, I saw a gun fire, we were connected by telephone line. We'd set up telephone lines and a buzzer in the system. And each time that particular gun fired, I would buzz. Then the other observation posts along, they would see if they could pick up the same flash as me, because my buzz they would hear. And if every time I buzzed, it was on the one they were seeing, they knew we were looking at the same gun. They could give their angle of sight to it. I could give my angle of sight to it. And then they would converge, and we'd know where that gun was firing from. So we were doing that during the night.
And you were able to do that?
We were able to do that.
Were you getting buzzes from then as well? So the system worked?
I think we were in the four there, in that position. I don't remember getting buzzes from the others. I think we had a very good position, probably better than some of the others.
Now, yeah. While you were there, you had a bit of a close escape from a shell from the
oh, yeah.
A big gun. You think it was the Merville battery? I'm not sure.
Yeah,
that was
it was. We knew it was a huge gun, and it was the only gun ever where you heard the sound of the gun firing before the shell arrived. The shell was so huge and travelled comparatively slowly, you knew it was coming. And this thing landed just at the side of the maternity home, this huge explosion. And it was the only time in the whole of the war that I was scared, frightened, and panicked.
What did you do?
I was just coming out of the building when this happened. And I ran in a circle. I was looking for somewhere to go. And in panic, I just ran in a circle. And then in the end, I think I went into the woods and got into where the water tower was by then. But that was the only time I did panic. She didn't know if another one was going to arrive. And they were huge shells, caused a lot of damage, of course.
Now, one thing, this was a maternity home, obviously. Were there still people in there?
Yeah.
Because you make reference, and I'm surprised they weren't evacuated or sent somewhere else.
Nowhere for them to go. They were virtually living in cellars. They weren't up through the building at all. Babies were being born, babies were being cared for, nursing staff and all were working in the cellars. The only people upstairs were mostly the nursing staff in things like the pharmacy and things like that, where it was on the top level. But then they would go down into the cellars with the patients and the children. And in daylight, if there was no shelling going on, they would take a risk and bring them out for a little walk around in the fresh air. We used to call it the parade of the pregs, the pregnant women.
Did you speak to them? I mean, did you get on well with any of the friends?
The staff, yeah.
The staff more than the women?
Didn't have any contact with the patients, none at all. No, but the staff, yes, they came out, well, they used to come out talking to us, and we got very friendly with them. As the actual pharmacist, she got talking to me, and we became quite friendly there. And then there was a man there, Andre. He and this Therese used to come to me, and we got very, very close. Pigeon English, pigeon French.
Now, what about, there's a case of a shell shock victim that you encountered in the woods. Tell me that story.
Yeah, what happened there was, it was rather quiet one morning, and I saw a man stagger out of the woods at the side of the maternity home. And I got on to him, and he was obviously very confused. And we got him back, and actually took him to the pharmacy, and the pharmacist gave him an injection of camphor, which I'd never heard of before. Apparently it was a stimulant or something or other. And he got him onto a stretcher, and he was telling us he'd been with his armoured unit going along the road. He'd been shelled and bombed several times, and he just couldn't stand it anymore. He'd just run away. So I got him on a stretcher, took him out through the woods, out to the main road. And when we got out to the main road, we started to walk towards where we understood there was some medical assistance, and an ambulance came along. It was traffic all the time, but in this traffic, there was this canvas-sided ambulance. They stopped and shouted, "Do you want medical care?" So yesterday he said, "One of you get in the back with him, take him in, and one of you get in the back with him." So we got this man in the back of the ambulance, and I got in with him. And we then set off down towards the Pegasus Bridge, actually, being shelled all the time in a canvas-sided ambulance. And inside the ambulance, in fact, there was I remember there was a sergeant there with a black M on his forehead, some sort of chalk or something, indicating he'd been given morphine and he wanted a cigarette. So I took out one of his cigarettes and lit it for him. But then when we got to this forward medical station, it had been scooped out of the ground, obviously, by mechanical means, and tentage put over the top of it. So it was stuck in the ground to get some protection from shell splinters. And then this shelter over the top, of a bit like a huge marquee, put over the top. And inside that, they had tables and so on, and the medical staff and the doctors and so on. And I took this man in, and they asked what it was, and I said we found him, he obviously had shell shock. And I'd written on a piece of paper exactly what he'd been given by the pharmacist, this injection, the quantity he'd been given. And they were really chuffed by that and said, "You know, are you in medical work?" I said, "No." I said, "Done any medical work?" "Only in the boys' brigade." But they were chuffed that they knew what he'd had, because usually they came in, they just didn't know, apparently. So they took over then, and we wandered back to our own place. It wasn't a great distance to walk back.
Now, what about, you were getting ready for the assault on Caen, weren't you?
Mm.
And what do you remember? So you were sort of identifying German artillery positions.
That's what we were doing all the time. We weren't in a position where we could see troop movements, because we were looking over the trees, and that shielded any ground, viewing of the ground ahead of us. Otherwise, we'd have been trying to search for tank movements and troop movements and so on. But at that point, all we could do was look for the guns.
Now, what do you remember of the assault on Caen? I mean, did you see it? Could you see it? Did you see the bombing raid that went wrong or half wrong, you know?
Yeah, we saw, again, we couldn't see it on the ground, but we saw all the planes going over and could hear the bombing taking place. And of course, by then, our artillery was opening up as well. And there was I think I said or wrote somewhere that I couldn't imagine anything but that France was going to be split in half. There was so much bombardment going on at that point in time. It was enormous, almost frightening just to listen to.
Now, so you'd been there at Benneville for quite a while.
Yes, we're there. Several days, anyway. Several days.
Now, when the Caen battle makes some progress, what happens next? You seem to have a farewell party. That sounds a nice story. Tell us about that. You know, the human side.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, the staff, all these nurses and that used to come down and to them. You know, we were liberators. We were marvelous people to them. They wanted to give us things and relate to us in any way they could. You know, these were the liberators there. And we got very friendly with them. And we almost paired up, you know, sort of one girl would sort of get to know one of the soldiers best of all. And I say in my case, it was Teresa, the pharmacist. And when we were going to leave there, we were told the evening before that we'd be off. So they all came down and we all sat around together and had a sing-song and chatting and that. And then they left us, but in leaving us, there was a lot of tears. They were saying goodbye, you know, clutching us and kissing us goodbye and tears flowing. And somebody, I think it might have been Andrews, walking back, saw the girls that went back. And he said he saw Teresa, in fact, go back, turn and walk to the edge of the wood and stood there crying. You know, these were the people who'd come and in place of the Germans, and they were leaving again. Obviously, we were special because we were the liberators.
Now, where did you move forward to?
Well, we went through, as a column had been fallen then, and we moved beyond that into this.
Did you go through Khan? Do you remember the state
yeah.
of it?
Oh, dreadful. Dreadful.
In what way?
It was just a ruin. They were just trying to sort, they were just clearing the roads enough for traffic to get through, but there was hardly anything standing that was recognisable. One annoying thing there was a chimney there, a tall chimney, which we were convinced they were using as an observation post. We gave its position and got our artillery to fire at it. The bombers came in and went by, and right to the very end, that flipping chimney was still standing there. We just didn't manage to knock it down. But we think they were using it. But anyway, we went through Khan and went to Colombo, was it, where we went into a brick factory?
Honorine Chowderette first?
Could be.
I can't see anything about a brick factory yet. Carmel's is a bit later, yeah.
Right.
The first one is Honorine. You're not quite sure. Honorine Air Chowderette. You're in an orchard. What do you remember of that?
Well, that's probably the orchard where we thought there was a sharpshooter in the woods nearby.
I don't know.
A sniper?
There's a machine gun fire in the road. What do you remember of it?
Well, there's a timing of this. If it's machine gun fire, it could be that it was the time when the...
We're in an orchard surrounded by high trees with booby traps.
Yeah, well, we were warned of that all the time. There's booby trap warnings around there. I think that was the orchard where we thought there was a sniper. And we got all organized, got our rifles and grenades and all that to go and find this man. And when we got there, it wasn't a sniper at all. It was a cow straying around in the woods, which was unusual because nearly all the animals have been killed by shrapnel.
Now, what about this booby trap problem? What do you remember of that?
It was only a matter of being warned. We were very wary about going anywhere into any buildings or anything like that, because they did do a lot of booby trapping. Even dead people they booby trapped, we were told. So, you know, we were careful what we touched.
Did you ever see any or identify any German booby traps?
No, there were times when we were in the building where we were told it was booby-trapped, so we were careful not to move anything. Because by moving it, you could set it off.
But not you did, that's not anything else you remember. Now, there's this incident where you're nearly shot. There's an air raid. An enemy aircraft attacks you on a road.
Yeah, I was walking along the road, and a sergeant was back behind me, a long way back, and he shouted and shouted and waved his arms around, pointed the sky, indicating the aeroplanes. So I quickly understood there were German planes coming. He'd seen them approaching. I thrung myself into a ditch at the side of the road, and just as well I did, because a few seconds later, machine gun bullets were hitting the ground up through that road. If I hadn't have moved, 3 seconds later, I'd probably have been dead. I can thank the sergeant for warning me they were coming.
There's also a V1 incident.
Yeah, that was. We didn't know what it was initially, of course. It's just a strange throbbing thing that looked a bit like a plane came over, suddenly turned around in a circle, went backwards, dropped down to ground and exploded. So it was a V1 flying bomb, which in fact had proved faulty. They'd set it to fly towards our position, or the might have been over the channel, I don't know. But it actually turned around and went back and exploded in their own territory.
And then you're not quite sure where you are, but you move forward to a crossroads and Montgomery comes up. Tell us that story.
Oh, yeah.
It's not really often you see Montgomery that close.
No, this was an empty post office this building had been where we moved in on this crossroads. set up an observation post where we did have a very good observation. We could actually see, watch the enemy tanks moving and the infantry moving around on the ground. Perfect position for observing. Because during the day, we weren't observing gun flashes. We were reporting on anything that was of value to the forces. Any troop movements, any tank positions, anywhere any bombs were landing, if the planes were coming in, to let them know how successful they were with their bomb aiming and so on. But whilst we were there, suddenly this little patrol came up of jeeps. There was Montgomery in it. Everything all drawn up in lack of camouflage, of course. I mean, everything was white and spick and span. You know, we were there keeping out of the way, everything camouflaged, and these came up and could be seen by anybody. Didn't stay very long and went off. Just after that, obviously they had been seen, and mortar shells starting to arrive. I remember I went back and dived in between the building and the vehicle we had there until the mortar firing stopped. And it was from that same position that one of our officers was walking along and someone took a shot at him, apparently from a cornfield nearby. So we again gathered up all our arms and went in through that cornfield slowly, scouring to see if we could find where the sniper was, but we never managed to discover. He probably fired his shot and run back out of the way.
Now, where did you go through next then? You seem to go to Cormel's.
Yeah, well, I think that's where the
brickworks
were. Yeah.
And what do you remember about that?
Well, it was like a big area where all the lorries and that would normally be used, and our tanks were gathering in there. There was a tank regiment using the premises, and there was quite a tall building with offices and so on in, and on the top of that building, it was probably about the equivalent of about four stories high block of flats, probably. And on the top of it was the housing for the lift motor, because there was a lift inside. And that lift motor house was absolutely spot on for us, because it had windows around the side, and we were right on the very top of the building, and we had a good panoramic view all the way around. And incidentally, we go back a bit. We did see, whilst we were at that place on the crossroads, we did see our tanks move in there and attack the German tanks. And we were able to report what was happening there, where the tanks were moving and who was where, whether our tanks were and where theirs were retreating, because they did retreat, actually. But back to the brickworks, we were told, because we were observing things right in the front line, we had to know what was happening. Otherwise, we'd been reporting things that they knew about. In fact, you know, we've been wasting people's time. So one of the advantages we had in our work was to be kept very much informed of what was happening and what was going to happen. And at this particular point in time, we were told there was going to be a bombing raid, a 1,000 bomber raid or thereabouts coming in to bomb the enemy troops. And I think this was to do with closing the Falaise Gap. But they came, they had one plane in front who was like the marker, in effect. He was going to locate the target. And the others, he would drop a flare. So the bombers would come in and bomb into the flare. But he dropped it in the wrong place. Instead of over the Germans, he dropped it over the Polish troops who were standing by ready to move in as infantry. And they dropped their bombs. I was up in this motor room on the roof, sitting with headphones on, observing. The next thing I knew, I was outside on the roof, outside the door, headphones off, they'd been torn off. I was laying on the tarmac, and within about a yard of where I was, there was a great big piece, splinter of shell of the bomb in the tarmac, and the sizzling away, tarmac was melting around it. It was as near as that. But I was able to get back onto the telephone and communicate back what had happened. And the second load of bombers were coming in to bomb into the smoke of the first lot. And they tried, we were kept in touch all the time, they tried all the time to communicate with these planes that were coming in, and they couldn't get on the same wavelength. In the end, a Typhoon plane was sent up, and it wove its way to and fro in front of them, and they still came on. So the Typhoon actually shot off the tail of the leading American plane. Then they realized that something was wrong, and they did turn around and go back. But of course, the airmen that were in that plane, when they landed, had to be taken into custody and brought back to headquarters for questioning. Not my post, but one of the other posts, observation posts, was where one of these airmen landed from his parachute, and they had to take him back to headquarters for questioning. But the poor old Polish troops had a terrible pasting.
Now, you were monitoring the area. There were tanks in the area, weren't there? And you were monitoring the operation. Tell us a bit about
that. No, we didn't see much of the tanks from there. The tanks were operating from there, but we didn't have to follow their activities at all.
It's just in your thing. You've got this story about looking at a burnt-out tank.
Well, that was they were operating, but not in front of us. They were way to our side, not the direction in which we were looking. They were further away to our right. But one of the tanks was brought back in and stopped in the yard, and someone was going around asking for volunteers to take out the men who were inside. The tank had been burnt out, and I went up and I looked down through the conning tower, and there was two, not much more than sort of pillars of carbon, really. So you could see black, and the features had all been burnt away. But it was two men, the remains of two men, and they wanted a volunteer to go down there and, in effect, I suppose, almost shovel this out and get it up so it could be put away for burial.
And you didn't volunteer?
I didn't volunteer, no.
Do you know what type of tanks it had been?
It was an ordinary Sherman, I'm sure.
And do you know which unit?
No.